Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, Eileen Pollack is the author of 5 novels, 2 collections of short stories, textbooks on creative writing, and a creative nonfiction work made into a movie starring Jessica Chastain. We'll be talking with her in just a moment. She's formerly the director of the MFA program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. Eileen Pollack's work has appeared in Best American Short Stories, Pushcart Prizes, and Best American Essays. Welcome, Eileen Pollack.
Oh, my pleasure. Delighted to be here.
Very pleased to have you here today. I should say the title of your new book is called The Professor of Immortality. And so much to discuss here because you have such an interesting background. But let's begin with an overview of the story. I love that you have a strong female protagonist, someone who has felt really fulfilled in her personal life, in her professional life. She founds the Institute of Future Studies at the university where she's a professor. Things are going really great, and then all of a sudden things change for her. So take it away for us.
Yes, everything falls apart. Her husband dies, and her son goes missing. I mean, he's in his 20s, so it's not as if he's a small child, but she's very worried about him. So when the novel opens, this is someone who, the reason she studies immortality is she's always wanted to live forever, can't quite accept that human beings would die, but by the time the novel opens, she's not quite sure she can even get out of bed in the morning to face the new day. And then to top it all off, when she reads the newspaper, there's a manifesto has been printed. It's sort of reminiscent of the Unabomber's manifesto, if you remember that. And she has the sinking feeling that she's read some of the sentences before. She thinks she recognizes the manifesto as the work of a former student of hers. In fact, a student she was very fond of and a student who was friends with her son. So she's not quite sure what to do, whether to turn him in or not. She's not sure she's right, and she is very afraid of implicating her son.
Yeah, so this sets her off on her journey, right? Because, as you said, she didn't know whether to turn him in or not. And so it sets her off on her own journey to try and figure things out.
Right.
And so why did you write it that way? Why did she not choose to go to the FBI, as she probably should have done, right?
Well, she, as I said, she's not sure. She was very fond of the student, and she really doesn't want to ruin her son's life or perhaps get him killed if she's wrong. Even she's not quite sure she would send him to prison. It's based on the inspiration for the novel came when the real Unabomber's manifesto was printed, and it was his own brother who recognized his writings and was really conflicted about whether to turn in his brother. He couldn't believe that he was guilty, but also wasn't sure he wanted to, you know, send him away either for life or have him executed. But of course he did. And When it was revealed that the Unabomber was Ted Kaczynski, I was teaching at the University of Michigan, and it turned out that Kaczynski had been a graduate student in math at my university for 5 years, and one of his professors said that Ted had been his favorite student ever, got the only A+ he'd ever given.
Wow.
And it set me thinking, you know, what if this had been a former student of mine? I mean, the other connection was that Kaczynski had sent one of his bombs to a professor at Michigan before his identity was known, and one of the graduates of our creative writing program was in fact working for that professor and opened a package and was severely injured when the package exploded. So I felt all these connections.
Right. So I'm trying to remember how long ago it was when the manifesto came out, because it came out.
Oh, yes. I fiddled with the time. That's what's confusing with you, probably confusing you. The real manifesto came out in 1995, but I wanted to make the novel more contemporary. So, in fact, mine is set in 2012.
So this story was brewing for a long time with you then, right? Did you start writing it then, or at what point did you start writing it?
No, but it was brewing in my mind for a long time. So it actually was brewing from 95 until 2012 when I sat down to actually write it. But a lot of things came together. I mean, if you read the manifesto, Kaczynski was talking about climate change and the way industry and technology were destroying the environment, would threaten to kill millions of people, wipe out whole species, and that technology was going to change our lives and destroy our privacy in ways that were really problematic. And, you know, I've always been interested in technology and the future, and so I had been thinking about a lot of the issues he raised for a long time.
It's always interesting what sparks an idea for a story, and sometimes how long that takes to come to fruition. It's like, okay, now's the right time to do this for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that made me go back to it was that so many of these young men, these young white male domestic terrorists we have now, some of them we call incels, or, you know, some of them are white supremacists. In the 1960s, they were more likely to be people on the left, you know, have really been threatening our culture and, you know, our lives. And Kaczynski is a very interesting example of an angry young white guy. And, you know, what made him so angry? What changed him from being, you know, this math student who was a good boy trying to please everybody to being this serial murderer? I felt that I'd had many students like him, and I really wanted to understand, like, what kind of pain or loneliness transformed them into, you know, these terrorists.
Right. So what did you come up with when you were trying to understand that? It's fascinating trying to understand why people do what they do. But did you come to some conclusions around that?
Well, I never come to conclusions, but I always feel like at least I've thought about the question more deeply. I mean, in Kaczynski's case, you know, he was the child of immigrants. He was working class. He was very, very bright. He was bullied. When he was at Harvard, he was ostracized, you know, for being sort of poor and different, and, you know, he didn't have a very good pedigree, and he was so much younger. He was the subject of some really upsetting psychology experiments at Harvard, too, that certainly didn't help his psyche any. But mostly at Michigan, what really touched me was he was so deeply lonely, so isolated, and so much pain from that. He just wanted a woman to love him and to be loved by a woman and to love her. And he didn't know how to do it. And I think he was very angry at a society that valued him for his brain, or parents, that he blamed a lot on his parents. And I'm very interested in loneliness as a factor in people's lives and what that does to them. And I think it quite literally drove him mad. His anger at being so unable to find someone to love him and be loved.
Mm. So let's look at that a moment, because, you know, they say technology is supposed to connect us more, social media is supposed to connect us more, but it's actually causing feelings of isolation and depression and anxiety in people, according to many, 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 many good studies. Your protagonist in the book directs the Institute for Future Studies, and the members of that institute try to predict the effects of technology on human life. Where do you see us going with that?
I think it's complicated, but one thing I was trying to get at in the book is that the people who are designing our future, the people who are so-called futurists, who are studying the effects of all this technology, tend overwhelmingly to be straight white men, often very young straight white men, and they are sort of designing the future for the rest of us. And I don't think that often they really are old and wise enough or diverse enough to be doing a very good job of that. And so their notion of what we want from technology, I think, is very different from what might actually make our lives much richer and better, and that it is, you know, connection and love and a sense of purpose that then make life seem worth living, and that technology may sometimes help with that, but very often, you know, creates just a sense of everybody else has something I don't have.
Yeah.
You know, when Kaczynski really was, you know, carrying out his acts of terrorism, there wasn't social media, so it's hard to tell whether he would have been better off with Twitter or not. I can't imagine he would have been. You know, when I set the novel, I'm really looking at that. And one reason I wanted to set this on a college campus is I just love listening to my students talk about technology. They are not naive about it. I think I had one of my students say, you know, can we all just agree Facebook is evil and over and be done with it? You know, people are hooked in, but I think they're thinking about what it's doing to them. So yeah, I don't know that I have any answers, but I like to think I used the novel to try to think about the questions.
That's so interesting. I'm interested to hear that your students think that way, because I have six grown nephews and nieces, a whole bunch of babies, but six grown ones, and none of them really like Facebook or Twitter. They don't do Twitter or anything like that. They want human, you know, human face-to-face connection. So it's interesting to say your students talk the same way, really. And I love what you said here as well. You just said that, you know, most of technology is being designed by young white males who are designing the future for the rest of us. I'd never kind of thought of it that way, but it's true. And so when people feel they don't fit in, it's not necessarily they don't fit in. It's just that technology is being designed by, you know, people they maybe wouldn't necessarily connect with on a day-to-day basis.
And so one thing I was looking at in the book, and people think I'm a little crazy, but this whole notion of immortality, or if not immortality, then really extended lifetimes, you know, I think Ray Kurzweil thinks that by the middle of this century, we're going to be living forever as half cyborg or whatever. And I think he's overly optimistic, but I think by the next century, people, you know, at least well-off people will be living hundreds of years. And nobody's thinking about what that's going to be like. What's that going to do to marriage, to careers, to, you know, how we treat our parents or grandparents? If you thought you were going to have your parents or grandparents for hundreds of years, would you ever bother to go visit them? You know, what's it going to do to literature, religion, art? And I know it sounds like it's sort of not an immediate problem, but it's all these things are coming, and we're not thinking about them, or they're being thought about by 25-year-old guys who are having so much fun playing with their toys that they think they want to live forever. Ask somebody who's 60 or 80 whether they want to live forever or what that would be like. So I'm just trying to get people thinking about who's designing driverless cars for us, right? And are they thinking about how we're going to get, you know, if you have a 13-year-old daughter or an 8-year-old daughter who needs to get to ballet lessons, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to put her in a car with a bunch of strangers and send her off with no driver to get to, I mean, if you don't have your own car, what does that mean? What are you going to do? I just think that people designing our technology are not necessarily living the same lives as most of the people who would be using what they're designing.
Yeah, I think there's so much truth in that. And to be quite honest, I had never thought of that before, even though I do work with a lot of tech guys. You know, many of them can't even make eye contact, to be quite honest.
You know, my undergraduate degrees in physics, I love technology. I love thinking about science, but it's just, it's so complicated. And it's so hard to keep up with thinking about all these things. And part of what I was interested in is when Kaczynski wrote the manifesto, right, let alone today, this notion that Yes, millions of people are going to die from global warming, or, you know, millions of species are going to be wiped out. And mm-hmm. he was saying, you know, we need to start a revolution and prevent that from happening and destroy all our technology and go back to living sort of a subsistence farming life. Maybe that's not the answer, and killing people to bring about, you know, to make all that stop isn't the answer. But if governments and corporations aren't listening, at one point is radical action too radical to prevent millions of people from dying and so many species from being wiped out? Where, yeah. you know, if you're not going to become a domestic terrorist about that, which I hope we're not.
Right.
Well, you know, I mean, then there's Greta Thunberg. But is anybody listening to her? Will anything change? What if, you know, that kind of frustration that she clearly feels, you know, what's that going to translate into? You know, so those are some of the issues I was really trying to explore when I wrote this book.
Right. And I know you have a degree in physics, right?
I do, yes.
Yeah, so it all makes sense. The work that you're writing all across the board, it all makes sense here, as well as teaching creative writing. I mean, it all comes together. I want to just touch on this, because we talked about Ted Kaczynski being the inspiration for your techno-bomber. Now, as far as I recall, Kaczynski was anti-tech. I think that was one of his issues, wasn't it, in the manifesto?
Right.
Yeah. So tell us how you developed your character, the techno-bomber, how you developed him and how he differs. Because he is also what we might call an incel, right?
Right. So I read whatever material I could find about Kaczynski's life. There's some very good biographies, especially it's called A Mind for Murder by a writer named Alston Chase. And I've never met the man, but I feel like I developed some understanding of what he had been through. And then, so my character is very much based on him, but then, of course, what happens in the novel never happened, so I'm taking a character based on a real person and then having a made-up person based on me,
right.
sort of interact with him. And then I have to admit, I changed history a little in how his story plays out. I don't want to spoil the ending for people, but I very much was thinking about Kaczynski, and especially his time at Michigan, which, of course, is what interested me the most.
Yeah. And so the book, you know, lest people think this is all about terrorism, the book has been described as a tragic comedy about the paradoxes of trying to be a decent human being and a decent mom. We're talking about Maxine, the protagonist. Is that a fair statement, do you think?
I think it's probably a little less comic than that description would lead you to believe. I do often write in a very comic mode, but I also have this much more serious mode. But apparently, even when I'm writing what I think of as my serious mode, readers find quite a bit to laugh about. And I was very interested in Maxine's relationship to her son. There's sort of a parallel between her son and the Kaczynski character, in that her son is very, very sensitive to the injustices of the world from his earliest times. And I think she's afraid he will grow up to be like more like Kaczynski, and tries very hard as a mother, especially after her husband dies, as a single mother, to make sure that her son can connect and love and be loved in the sorts of ways that maybe the Kaczynski character wasn't able to accomplish. And so it's, you know, I'm interested in young men, and I've written so much about young women and the obstacles they face and sexism, but I'm a mother of a son, and I'm also really interested in what it's like to grow up as a young man in today's society. And, you know, so that was part of what I was trying to explore as well.
Right. Well, the book is called The Professor of Immortality. It is a novel. Publishers Weekly describes it as a blended crime thriller and family drama into a provocative novel. So let's talk a little bit. Let's just pause on this, your interest in young men, because we've heard so much about young women, and not just young women, but women lately, with all of the movements going on. And yet men are having their own issues too. I've done a couple of shows with men who've written books specifically on male issues. From your perspective, what issues are they facing that we're maybe not aware of or paying attention to?
Well, you know, for Maxine's son, he's so ashamed of being a privileged white male that he almost feels like he doesn't deserve to breathe air, you know, that he's taking up space, and he's devoting his life to, you know, helping oppressed minorities and people who have not don't have enough to eat, but it's almost driving him crazy, because you can grow up so guilty for just existing. And I know that's not the problem for maybe the majority of young white males, privileged young men, but I do teach a lot of young people who are like that, and maybe it's only at a nice university where I've been privileged to teach myself, but, you know, that's something I was thinking about. And then for the others, you know, that sort of anger, that rage against women that or the sense that they now are being put on the spot, that they're, you know, it's bad to be a straight white male regardless, and feeling like you're not going to inherit the world or whatever. Some aspects of that anger I have no patience for, but some aspects of it, you know, my heart does go out to, you know, young people who are angry, lonely, in pain, and don't know what to do about it, don't know how to find meaning in their lives. And I'm just, I think in some cases the loneliness, pain, and, you know, comes first, and then the person finds an ideology to sort of mask that, to be, you know, the forum for the pain. And I think Kaczynski did. But even without that, I just wonder if we can't do a better job of raising people to know how to connect with each other, to find love, to find meaning in their lives. A lot of that used to come from religion, from, you know, aspects of community, patriotic service, you know, family, traditional roles of masculinity and femininity that we, you know, I'm glad we have challenged and in some cases done away with, but I'm not sure what we're putting in their place.
Right.
And I've taught for so many years, and I think young people are often really searching for, you know, sources of meaning and love and connection in their lives, and I'm not quite sure what we're giving them. And many of them are just told, you know, if you really do well on your exams, you'll get a good job, earn enough money, and somehow that'll magically make your life okay. And
Not true. I want to ask you about this because you wrote a book in 2012, which was a New York Times editor's choice in 2012. It was called Breaking and Entering, and it was a novel also. But it was about the deep division between blue and red America. And now 7 years on, we have more division than ever. Did you see that gap widening as you wrote that book?
Well, you know, that came about because when I moved from Boston to Michigan in 94, right after I moved there, Timothy McVeigh blew up the Murrah office building in Oklahoma City, and it turned out he had some ties to what was called the Michigan Militia. And I thought, oh my goodness, what if I moved, you know? And I was just became very interested in these militia groups, far right groups, fundamentalist groups in my new state. And I couldn't understand how in one state, sometimes in one small town, you'd have people who were so liberal, so far to the left, and people, their neighbors, who were so far to the right and thought the government was going to come take them away, the Bill Clinton years and then later the Obama years, and were out training in the woods with, you know, their assault weapons. And I did a lot of research, and I, based on actually a friend's experience, she and her husband had moved from Marin, California to a small town in Michigan and discovered that their neighbors were very different from themselves. So I wrote this book about trying to explore that difference and what it meant for Michigan, for America. And it took me the longest time to get that book published because editors in New York thought I was nuts. They were like, racism, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, people running around in militias in the woods. They just couldn't believe it. And then I finally got it published, and there was some sense of, oh, yeah, I guess this is there. And really, it's only recently that people are sort of saying, oh, that's what your book was about.
Right.
So I can't say it's gotten worse. I just say people suddenly are awake,
aware,
alive to it.
Aware, yeah. I also want to just touch real quick on a nonfiction book that you wrote, The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys' Club. And, you know, I talked with somebody very recently, just a few weeks ago, who still feels it's that way in Silicon Valley. She talks about she had a TED talk that went absolutely viral around the world, and yet a similar talk in Silicon Valley, she said, just absolutely bombed. Are you finding that too?
Well, so that book, which was, as you said, nonfiction, came about because I was a physics major. My degree is in physics. I felt passionately about the subject, wanted only to be a physicist, and then walked away, got the degree, walked away from it, and never did anything with it. And then years later, in 2005, when Larry Summers, then president of Harvard, was wondering where all the female physicists and mathematicians were at his university, I thought, well, now why didn't I go on? And has that changed at all? And so when I did the research, and this was already between 2005 and 2012, I found that very little had changed between the 1970s when I was in school and the 2000s in terms of what was keeping women out of the hard sciences and tech. And I think that my book, I like to think, helped start the conversation. Because I had left the field, I was able to be brutally honest about the obstacles that I hadn't been able to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it opened the conversation for other women. And, is it getting better? At least we're talking about it. Some companies, some institutions are trying to make changes. Young women are much more conscious of, I think they thought that all that happened in the bad old days and couldn't imagine what was keeping them from going on in science and tech. So I think everybody's just eyes are more open now.
Right. So a couple of questions I have on writing, Eileen. You have such an interesting body of work based probably on your interests, fiction, nonfiction. How do you approach writing fiction differently than you might nonfiction, or do you?
Not too differently, I have to say. It's usually a matter of whether I want to hide my tracks or not. do I want to pretend that none of this really happened, or, protect certain people, be able to change things a bit. But I don't write too differently in the two genres. I'm always trying to think about a question that interests me, think about some aspect of my life that interests me, or, where my life intersects with the broader culture. So not too different. I think what might be different is in nonfiction, I don't always use a narrative, so I'm not always telling a story. I might take my readers on a journey or use something spatial to structure the narrative. So I once wrote an essay that's just structured around the ranch house I grew up in, right? And I just take you from room to room in the ranch house and what happened there, rather than telling a story. So that's one difference, but mostly not very different.
Mm. So you earned an MFA in creative writing from University of Iowa. Was that worth it to you? And then you went on to teach, right?
Yes. It's funny because we all just had a reunion. Connie Brothers, the woman who ran the program at Iowa for something like 45 years, just retired, a wonderful woman. So I was just there a week ago. I hadn't been back in ages. It was a very mixed experience. In some ways, it was a brutal awakening. People were not always kind about what you had written. On the other hand, truly amazing writers, and had some amazing teachers who changed my life, and I learned a great deal. But it was it was an awakening in all ways.
Right.
Right. Yes, and I mean, and I just, you know, I taught for many, many years in the MFA program in Michigan and directed it for 5 years, and we tried to be just as honest, but much kinder and
right,
not brutal. But yes, I think there's a great deal that people can learn from a writing program, and you have, you know, a number of years to write without needing to pay the rent or you know, satisfy your parents that what you're doing makes sense.
Right, right. So having now written several books, share with us two things that you know now that you wish you'd known when you set out to write your first one.
I always tell my students, all you learn is that you can do it. You know, the first few times, you're just so overwhelmed, you don't think you're going to be able to pull it off. And then you remember, oh, wait, that's how I felt the first time and the second time and the third time. So I think it gets a little easier to have confidence in yourself.
Mm.
And I think I just would trust what really comes from a deep place inside you, right? That if you're writing from something you really feel or care about, it's going to succeed. You're going to find a form for it. You're going to find a way to get that across. You don't want to be writing what you think you should write. You want to write what you have to write.
Yeah, I love that. I know listeners can find out much more about you at eileenpollock.com. The book, your new novel that we talked about at the beginning of the show, is called The Professor of Immortality. Final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with, Eileen?
I think we've covered just about everything.
But, we talked about a lot, didn't we?
It's just been a pleasure talking to you. Such good questions.
Thank you. Well, thank you for joining us. Very much appreciate it. And I'm sure this book's going to receive great accolades. Eileen Pollock, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.